Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What could you learn about yourself and the country you live in if you undertook a coast-to-coast journey relying on the kindness of strangers? Director, writer, and performer John Waters has the means to travel anywhere he wants these days, but thumbing his way across America was not about money. In fact, Waters dreamed up his undercover travel adventure a couple of years ago, in part because he craved adventure and in part because he wished to test his limits as the self-described ultimate control freak, putting himself at the mercy of people who didn't know and who might not recognize him to get him to the West Coast. He shares what happens in the 21 rides he bummed to get himself to San Francisco in his new book, Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. We'll hear more about that later, but he is also going to be in town May 29th for a live show called This Filthy World. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you. And as you can hear, I have a little bit of laryngitis, so you might think it's Kathleen Turner, but it's actually John.
That's fine. Make sure you've got some. And I guess I take it you drink Evian most of the time, even when people might think you're homeless otherwise.
Yeah, I do like Evian. I know it's ridiculous, but I can taste it, although I'm suspicious. I've never seen a picture of this Evian well. Just how deep is it? I'd like to see a picture of it. Can you go swimming in it? I don't know. It just could be tap water, but it's good tap water.
Yeah, and if it comes all the way from France, it's got to be good, right?
Well, I think if it comes all the way to France, it just makes its journey more problematic and probably more unhealthy in a way. So, it's amazing. My father used to always say, "You buy water? What are you, crazy?" and it infuriated him. And now, as you know, in restaurants, tap water is in. Overnight, bottled water went out of fashion, which must cost the restaurant business a fortune. But people always say now, "Oh, no, I'll just have tap." Like if you ask for bottled water, you're a pig.
Right. Yeah, I like how they say sparkling or still now. It's
well, my favorite thing I ever heard on that, and I'm going to name drop here. I don't usually do that, but I was once at dinner on a yacht, and we went in Italy with Valentino, the designer.
Hmm.
And the waiter came over to him and said, completely seriously, "Would you like with bubbles or without bubbles the water?" And Valentino said, completely seriously, with no irony, "No, bubbles make you fat." Which I think every time anyone ever asks me that question, I've never had Perrier since.
You know, we just did a show last week about how human beings over time tend to change in some predictable ways, right? We get more conscientious over time, and most people seem to become less adventurous. And I wonder if you just think you don't have that gene, or have you fought deliberately against it?
Well, I feel that everything, I mean, the last movie I made got an NC-17 rating, so I sort of made a movie about sex addicts, so I sort of started at the beginning. The latest book I wrote is about who would hitchhike across America when you're 66 years old. I think I do like to have an adventure. I'm scared of staying home.
Hmm.
I'm scared of not flying. I'm scared of getting stuck. So my midlife crisis is not buying a sports car. I won't even get in a convertible at my age. Is really embarrassing. But to hitchhike across the country or to spend too much money on art that everyone else hates, that's my idea of a midlife crisis.
Have you always sort of decided who you were in contrast to the people around you?
I think so. When I was even in kindergarten, my mother told me, I used to come home and say, "There's this weird kid in my class, and he only draws with black crayons, and nobody will talk to him, and he's really weird." And I talked about him so much that my mother asked the teacher, and the teacher said, "Well, that's your son." So I was creating characters for myself. And when I was a kid, I pretended I was nude descending the staircase, the Duchamp
right.
painting I saw in Life magazine. So every day when I went to school, no one knew, but I was nude descending the staircase when I went down the stairs at Calvert School in Baltimore.
It's amazing when you talk about, you know, having spoken about yourself in the third person. It's like that Shirley Jackson story, right, about Charles or whatever, except that in this case, it was the teacher who had to tell your mother what the truth was.
Yes, and I don't use the royal me when, like some people do when they talk about themselves. I'm not that pretentious, I hope.
What do you think? I mean, I love the stories about your parents being really supportive of you, despite the fact that they must have wondered, what have we given birth to? And I don't say that in a way that is meant to be disrespectful, but you're not like your mom and dad.
It's like that ad. There's one thing wrong with a Waters baby. It's alive. I was born almost 6 weeks too early, so my friend Pat Moran says I was overly baptized. That's what happened to me, and it took too much original sin away, so I was damaged. Right from the beginning, I knew something was different. I didn't want to be what everybody else wanted to be. I had no interest in that. And Life magazine was the only real freedom I had, because I could read about beatniks, I could read about censorship, I could read about drug addicts, I could read about the cult of homosexuality, all these things that Life magazine went. And my parents always thought, isn't it nice he likes to go to the library? But I was looking up every devious thing, just trying. I wanted bohemia. I never knew there was such a thing until I read Tennessee Williams. But bohemia is what I was looking for.
Do you ever meet people who were raised in those environments and feel envious of them?
No, because I know some people that were raised with, you know, we're talking about maybe red diaper babies. Those were people that had communist parents. Which I definitely would have been a communist if I was in the 40s. It was like being a hippie. But I was a yippie, so I definitely would have been a reluctant communist. So to me, the people that grew up that way can rebel too, you know, and they became Republicans, or they became, you know, my parents were frightened of me, but they knew that I had obsessive interests in things. So I had a puppet show career for children's birthdays when I was 12 years old. So they were amazed by that. I mean, I had a career at 12. I got Variety when I was 14. So the movies I made, they were horrified by, but they thought, I think, what else could he do? We better stick with this, because what else could he do? They tried to, you know, later I taught in prison. I didn't go to prison. It's a thin line, especially in Baltimore, where the guards and the prisoners are the same.
So many people are surprised about the fact that you, I guess you have homes in a couple of other places, but Baltimore is really like the center of your life to this day.
Yes, it is.
And I wonder if we're just too closed-minded in this country about what it means to be a working artist, and why we assume that you have to be in a place like New York to really fulfill your creative potential.
I don't think anybody thinks that anymore. With the internet and global culture, it doesn't matter where I live as long as there's an airport near. These days, you can see every movie online. It used to be, when I was young, you had to move to New York or L.A. to see movies, to see art. You can see everything today. Everybody can be cool in no matter what little town they live in the world. There's cool people. They have access to everything. So in some ways, it's made it duller, because I travel all the time for work, and you can't tell the difference. Everywhere's the same now. It's the same chain stores from the airport. The kids look the same. It's the same everywhere. But it's much cooler everywhere. So I think in the long run, local color vanishes, but international coolness gets better. Although it can reach a peak, like in Berlin, where they have signs now that say, foreigners go home. And I thought, isn't that terrible? The poor Albanians. They mean hipsters, because so many hipsters from America move there that it's getting expensive. And it used to be the last cheap place to live.
Yeah, I suppose there's a question about what does cool mean anymore if, you know, with a certain amount of money to spend, everybody can fabricate something that seems cool. It's not it, it,
well,
it's something different.
Well,
right?
The money thing is a thing. I mean, you know, I that's why I'm not a hypocrite. I didn't march it. You know, I'm for the Occupation Baltimore. When they asked me to come down, I said, you know, I have three homes and a summer rental. It's a little hypocrisy of me to be down there, occupy Baltimore, you know.
You are the 1%.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'm the 1%. I'm maybe the 4%, if I sold everything. But at the same time, I understand that. I understand how much fun they had at Occupy Baltimore. The same fun I had going to Black Panther riots in the 60s. I was political, but then it was kind of more for fun. I think it is today, too. Riots are fun if no one's really hurt or anything. It's like playing cowboys and Indians. You throw the tear gas back, you run. Of course, now, as we know in foreign countries, it's not a play revolution like it sometimes was in the 60s here, when you were at Yale and protected by Yale University and given a place to stay. But I look back fondly on Yale for that.
You know, it could have gone a number of ways for you in your career. I think at this point you are well established and people recognize the work that you have done as being really creative and interesting and unlike what had come before. Would you be, do you think, if you're someone who really doesn't care what other people think, would you be equally happy still sort of laboring in obscurity on the same kinds of projects that you've always done?
No, I mean, I do care what people think. I think as you get older, bad reviews are much harder to take. When you're young, a bad review is at least they noticed.
Right.
I made a career out of bad reviews. They're tougher to take today because then there was a cultural war going on. It was us versus them. Now all critics are hip. They're not gonna fall for that kind of great line like Rex Reed used to give us that we would quote in the ads, terrible reviews. They're not gonna be that dumb anymore to do that. So I think if you try too hard to be transgressive, Bridget Berlin, the Warhol star, said the best thing to me. She said, "How can we be bad at 70?" Which is really a funny line. How can you rebel when you're 70 years old? Because as we all know, and I've said before, a 20-year-old person that's wild on drugs and drinks can be very sexy. There's not many 70-year-olds that are on drugs and liquor that are very much fun. You know, you become a jerk as you get older if you act like that.
Yeah, I suppose the drugs are different. They're not, they give you side effects rather than making you
high. Well, I like the side effects. I have flashbacks to this day. I'm thrilled to have an LSD flashback at my age. But many of the friends that I took drugs with when I was younger did. I never had a bad experience with drugs, ever. I stopped taking them when I'd had enough of them. But I don't regret it. And my mother says, don't tell young people that. But there is some people can handle some things. Others can't. I mean, some people have one taste of heroin, and that's it. For the rest of their life, they like nothing better. And thank God that was not me. I think the only reason to ever take heroin is to listen to jazz, because jazz is the sound of heroin.
Your book made me think a lot about the nature of fame. In some cases, you're walking into like a McDonald's on the side of the road, hoping that people are staring at you because they recognize you rather than because they think you're some homeless weirdo. And I wonder about...
like <I'm> both.
You talk
the
about...
The thing is, in real life, the last thing I want is to go on a McDonald's and pose for 100 cell phone pictures. I do it, and I have no problem doing that because those people bought me my quarter pounder. But at the same time, when you're hitchhiking and no one will pick you up, it changes. And then you pray you get recognized. I was featuring my mustache heavily, just praying it did its job and get me a ride. But that is the opposite of what it's like to really go out in you know, public, because you're always get recognized pretty much. And what makes you angry is when you realize that when some people don't recognize you, you realize how crummy people are treated all the time. And then when they halfway through the encounter do and get nice to you, then I'm really mean to them. That's the only time I'm mean to people. When they change how they treat me if they suddenly know who I am, that means they're jerks.
Oh, like suddenly you matter because you're a famous person.
Yeah, because you're famous. That, you know, and that means they're climbers.
Hmm. John Waters is my guest. He's a writer, director, and performer with a show scheduled for May 29th at the Kessler Theater in Dallas called This Filthy World. He's also got a new book out called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. You're welcome to join our conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Bootcamp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer, director, and performer John Waters, who will be in town May 29th at the Kessler Theater for a show called This Filthy World. He's also got a new book out called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. How do you decide when you have an idea? How do you know, okay, this really works as stand-up or live show material? This might go into a book or a movie. Is it always evident to you from the beginning?
Well, you're right. I can recycle things. I'm like Bob Hope. I have like a little drawer of jokes, you know. And, you know, I'm the host of this year's Fashion Oscars in New York. So I took out anything I would do about fashion in this filthy world because I put the best of that into this thing. So, and I try to, if I've ever written it and it's been published and never use it again in a book, so which is quite complicated. Luckily, with computers, make that a lot easy to check that you haven't used a joke in one way elsewhere. And this filthy world, I mean, this is a show I've been doing for years, but this one should actually be called This Filthy World, Filthier and Dirtier, because I always put new stuff in it. I'm always updating it right till the day I get there. So it's never exactly the same, but it's all completely written and rehearsed and learned, and it's myself on stage for 70 minutes with no notes, and it is completely memorized. So it's my anti-Alzheimer's exercise, too, I think, performing on the road. And I also have a Christmas show, which I've done, but this is different than that. So, and I'm not hitchhiking to Dallas. I have a first-class seat where everyone's ugly. You should know that in first class. Everyone is so ugly. Watch a plane let out. The ugliest people get out first. It's a shame. You'd think there'd be cute people in first class. Rich people are ugly.
Well, I guess they can be, right?
Sometimes they are, I'm telling you. That confidence is as it, I don't know, it turns into wrinkles later.
And then you can just get them ironed out of the plastic surgeons, though, right?
No, that's a worse look. That's panic, you know. Are you kidding? I mean, when people look permanently surprised, you know, it's a look I don't understand. Although there are great facelifts, they're the ones that you don't notice.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody said that's a good facelift, that means it's a bad one because you noticed.
Have you ever accidentally slipped and cut off part of your mustache?
Oh, of course, but it's half drawn on anyway. It doesn't matter. I'd like to shave the whole thing off and just draw it on. It'd be a lot easier. And Melanie Griffith tried to talk me into tattooing it on because I think she once had her lip liner or something tattooed on her makeup. But then I think as you get older, you have to get touch-up. So, no, you can. But I could shave this mustache blindfolded, and I think that I could do it without. Because you shave it, and then you trim the bottom. But really, I think I could do it with my eyes closed. I don't even think I have a mustache. I've done it for so long that I say, oh, I hate mustaches. I thought, are you kidding? You have a ridiculous one. But I don't ever even think that.
I suppose if you really wanted to be incognito, you could just get rid of it or grow in the rest of it, right?
No, if I want to be incognito, I know what to do. I wear Ravens outfits, like sports material, you know, like sports hats.
You don't really do that,
and
do you?
If I ever have, like one time I had to for personal reasons, and I wore a Ravens hat and also a, you know, the kind of mask you wear when you have the flu? That covers the mustache.
Huh.
So that can work in like Rocky pants, you know, exercise pants that I would never wear, you know. And I think they look good on others, but people would really not think that was my outfit. But I don't have, I'm not trying to be hidden anyway. It's not like I can't go out. It's not like I'm Justin Bieber. I love him now. Bizzle, that's his rap name. That's so great.
Do you love
Every
him because
day,
you think he's really good?
I just say it out loud. Pardon?
Do you think he's really good?
Well, I didn't say that. I think he's incredibly talented, mm-hmm. Justin Bieber. Yes. If you saw that first documentary, they show all those pictures of him when he was like 8 years old, playing pots and pans in the kitchen and doing Aretha Franklin's Respect, and he was amazing. So I'm for him. I follow his career with great interest. I love it when he's black.
You know, when I think about, I guess he's a young man now, but he's like a product, right? Somebody made him before he had the choice to be who he is.
No, I disagree, because he was discovered by fans on YouTube. I think that's the opposite of that. I think he had groundbreaking support from regular people. And I think the manager, Scooter, did it a brilliant job of marketing him, because they took him around to teen girl clubs, like local places, and the audience was just the same, screaming, but there was 10 of them. And built that. I think he did an absolutely amazing job of grassroots support.
You mentioned earlier that you've done a Christmas show. I'm really interested in the Christmas cards that you have done over the years. Can you talk about how you started that tradition?
Well, I always think that I always take the Christmas kind of things that everybody does and make fun of them and embrace them. So I've designed my own Christmas card for probably since I'm 16. So that's 50 years worth, or no, more. I'm 50, how old am I? I don't know, 68. So I do them every year, and they sort of become like really my advertising for the year. Like my father's company used to send out a calendar with a girl on it, a pin-up girl in the 50s. Well, it's similar to that. It's something that I hope people will keep and hang up and remember me by. And so one year it was a Christmas ball, a clear Christmas ball, but inside it was a plastic roach. And people really thought it was a real roach. It was pretty good. This year I had another ball, but I have all different ones. Sometimes it's a card, sometimes it's an object, but it's only done to my personal list, which is really about 2,000 people now, but that's everyone, every friend, every person I've done business with through the years. So it's my yearly greeting.
Do you, like, if you get on a plane sitting next to some ugly person in first class, you seem very
including
social.
Including me. I mean, I'm not saying I look better because, you know, I see pictures of me and I think, oh, my God, you better put on a scarf or something. I'm not saying that I look better than everyone in first class.
But I wonder
I feel bad for the stewards that get jobs to have to sleep with the people in first class to marry up.
Well, I don't think they have to do that anymore, do they?
They don't have to, but I think, yes, if you're a gold digger and you're a flight attendant, wouldn't you want to be on first class to Europe flight? It's better pickings. You know, who's going to pick the person in the middle seat in the last row by the bathroom on coach? You know, you're not going to get much if you're a gold digger. Now, they're cuter. They're cuter. And more opt to the Mile High Club, which is very hard to do in coach.
Do you ever want to just sit there and, like, read your book, or are you always open to talking to who's next to you?
No, I always do sit there and read my book, and usually I have books with alarming titles like Lesbian Nuns and stuff like that, and people don't talk to you, or they start laughing. The best story I have in first class is I was sitting next to a black gentleman. I thought, who is this? I know who this person is. The whole flight, he never spoke to me. He was very polite, very well-dressed and everything. And we landed, and as we stood up to get off the plane, everyone in first class was like, ah, ha, ha, you were sitting next to Clarence Thomas the whole way. And I thought, oh, it was him. And would I have said something like, there's a pubic hair on my Coke? I might have, because I'm a big Anita Hill fan. And I don't know if you've seen the new documentary about her. That's quite, quite good. And it enraged me so much that I wish I had said that. But I did sit next to him the whole way. He did not speak to me. But generally, people confide in me ludicrous things. They just will turn and say to me something like, I don't know, my entire family had sex in an Easter basket. And I think, well, I'm so sorry to hear that. Or why did you tell me that? Because they think I will understand. And the question is, I will.
Yeah.
So I'm not the wrong person. I would be a good defense lawyer. I'd be a good psychiatrist.
What do you think makes you that way? Are you wired that way?
I'm wired to be interested in human behavior. That's what I do for a living.
Hmm. Is there anyone... Has there been anyone in your life that you've been, like, particularly invested in impressing that you struggled to get approval from?
Approval. That's a good one. I guess your parents, always, you know. And I think that by the time both my parents died at 90 years old, there was nothing left unsaid. I think that all the issues had been worked out, and the ones that were not worked out, I turned into a career.
That's the most you can ask for, isn't it, in a relationship with your parents?
I think you can't blame your parents after 30, even if they were the worst parents in the world. That's the hand you were dealt. It isn't fair, but move on and deal with it.
How do you...
Now, I can easily say that because, you know, I wasn't tortured as a child in a ring of child molesters. Or something. That's a whole different story.
But you can go one way or another. If you don't match up with your parents, really, there are two directions you can take. And you obviously took the more positive road.
Well, I always said the parents should be really glad if their kids are in trouble in high school. That means they'll be leaders in the arts. Because the day after graduation, the prom queen, the football star, their life's downhill. You know, I don't go. I had my 50th high school graduation. I didn't go. And I joked to the guy something about Columbine. I thought, oh, you can't joke like that. But that'd be a good movie. Is anyone still that mad about high school 50 years later that comes in for revenge at the reunion? The reason to go to the reunion is see people that you were sexually attracted to. And I've already stalked their house years ago. And what's really embarrassing, now their children look like that. And worse, their grandchildren, they don't look like what you remember.
Yeah, I suppose that must be very surreal after a certain, it's been 25 years for me, but there's something that happens, I guess, after 50 that is really different.
Well, you don't recognize them. I mean, I have to carry my yearbook around and, like, look at them. And any of the people I cared about there, I'm friends with now. I want to be harder to reach. I don't want to. And people say to me a lot, come up, do you remember me? And I have an answer that works, and you can use this, and it doesn't matter if it's true or not. You just say, I'm sorry, I took LSD. I don't remember anything. And they go, oh, okay. And they walk away. They're not insulted.
See, that wouldn't work for Clarence Thomas, though.
Well, it might. I mean, because then people would say, well, you didn't talk to him. You're lying.
Did it occur to you
that... Well, he never comments on anything. Isn't yeah, that what he
true.
Brags about? That's what I don't get. How can you be on the Supreme Court and brag that you don't say anything?
Did it occur to you that when you sat next to him, he might be thinking, who is this guy sitting next to me?
I don't think he would care. No, I don't think he would care rat's ass who I was or what I did. No.
All right, let's talk about...
Although he knew who Long Dong Silver was. So I take that back. Because when we were watching that hearing with my assistant at the time says, we have his phone number, which we did.
Like
he was in our office directory.
He was someone that you considered working with on a film.
Well, I had thought him up and had found out how to reach him at a time. Yes.
Tell me about your approach to casting and whether it's evolved over time and because you've certainly early on especially were known for taking people that weren't well known in mainstream culture, and then later on you've taken people who sort of have revived their careers in some cases based on having worked with you.
Well, I think I started like all kids making movies with your friends, and they became kind of the acting troupe that we used. And then starting with Liz Renee and then Tab Hunter, we got mixed them with what was known as Hollywood stars. And then in Crybaby, I practically invented stunt casting by putting, you know, Patricia Hearst and David Nelson married with Tracy Lords as their daughter. But then everybody started to expect that, so I stopped doing that and hired Melanie Griffith. You know, I have in Cecil B. DeMented, before they were really known, I had Adrian Grenier, I had Maggie Gyllenhaal, and Michael Shannon. And that was from Kerry Barton and also Pat Moran, who's cast all my movies, does The Wire and millions of movies. I think we cast people because they're so good, they're great. I've never casted anybody that I thought was a joke in any way. Even Pia Zadora, I got her good reviews in Hairspray, and she was good.
Is the joke when you are working and exploiting bad taste, the idea is that everybody knows, therefore, that you must know what good taste is, right? If you push
well,
the envelope
exploiting,
so hard.
I'm exploiting good taste, not bad, because you have to know good taste to make fun of it.
Yeah.
I fight the tyranny of good taste that I was raised in. But I don't think I have bad taste in real life. So I'm trying to make you be surprised at what taste is and how you can have some of both and mix it and come up with humor. The only way you can get anyone to change their opinion is to make them laugh, and that usually by challenging their taste in something.
Do you think the world's a better place today for a weird kid growing up somewhere away from the biggest cities in America?
Sure. I think it's better. I think it's kids can see everything online now. You know, they know what's going on. They don't feel as alone. But it's still not easy. And it's weird that it's a class issue now. Like in rich kids' schools, it's better to be gay. They say at NYU, gay by May, you know, which is kind of hilarious to me because in poor kids' schools, it's still not cool. Hmm. So when did it become a class issue? And I talk about in my show that I think we have enough gay people. I'm for coming in. I think gay people have to audition now in front of a panel of experienced perverts to get gay ID.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now. We have George on the line in Dallas. Hey, George.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you all doing?
Great.
I am so excited that to hear the show today and very excited about the show at the Tesla coming up.
You got a dog going along. It sounds like the Barking Dogs version of Jingle Bells.
Yeah, I know. We've got some kitchen work going on, and I've got a yappy dog, and she's going nuts. I'm trying to block that as best I can.
Oh, that's
but,
all right.
I've been a huge fan since about 84 when I was 17 and saw Pink Flamingos and have been following you since and just really loving everything you did. when I was
probably illegal for you to see Pink Flamingos at 17, but that's.
I think it was. It was a great theater we used to have. It's a live music venue now called the Granada, but they used to show great shows, and that was one of them. And it probably was illegal. It certainly felt illegal, but about probably 15 years ago, I was living in New York, and I was leaving a club. I wasn't feeling well, and I saw you there, and I was so excited to see you, but I didn't feel very good, and I ended up following you for about 6 blocks, only because we were going the same way. I wasn't stalking you at all, but I regretted not saying anything for so long.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you were going to puke on me or something. Like feeling well. You had the whirlies, and we're leaving it.
Well,
didn't Lady Gaga have someone vomit on her recently? That's called Roman showers. Well, it happens.
Was there, George, the 30 seconds before the break, is there something you've wanted to tell John Waters?
Just that I'm very excited that I will have the chance to see him again, and just what a huge fan I've been and how he has really enriched my life.
Thank you. And, you know, the Dallas show is the first book signing for Karsak I'm having in the whole country, so it's going to be exciting.
Wow. All right, great. Well, we will come back in just a minute with writer, director, and performer John Waters. He'll be in town May 29th for a show called This Filthy World and a signing of his new book, Karsak, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer, director, and performer John Waters. He will be in town May 29th for a show at the Kessler Theater called This Filthy World. And he has a new book out called Karsak, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk for just a minute about Hairspray, which may be the movie that people listening who have not seen all of your films are most familiar with.
Yes, and causes the most trouble if they've only seen that one and thinks the other ones are like it.
So people say, I love John Waters, and they have no idea.
Yeah. And no, and then they go in and get Pink Flamingos thinking it's about a musical about Florida.
Are you okay with that? I mean, there must be people who love Pink Flamingos and also love Hairspray, but it doesn't necessarily go the other way.
I don't know why, because they're the same. They say the same things, that the divine in Pink Flamingos was living alone, celebrating her uniqueness and was challenged by jealous people, evil people. The same thing in Hairspray. Ricky Lake just wants to be accepted and finally gets to be, but she has to fight for it. It's not so much different. It's just how they fight and what the war is, the battle of filth versus integration. Which is worse? I don't know. Segregation's worse than being filthy, certainly.
Is it strange to have something that you've created and then have someone else come along and expand on it and sort of not make it their own, but put their own spin on it?
It was thrilling. Are you kidding? It keeps on going because not only my movie, the musical, which was so amazing, they did such a beautiful job making it. I was involved in the whole process. And then they made a Hollywood movie that was a hit. I've been paid to write a sequel to both called White Lipstick that never happened. I was paid to write a TV series that might still happen. So Hairspray is the gift that keeps on giving. I want it to be on ice. I want to see all fat girls on skates. Or I want it to, you know, it can be endless. It can be endless. So, no, it is wonderful. I want that to happen to all my movies. Then I'll have to think up anything new.
when you decided to do your hitchhiking, I don't know if you want to call it a project. What do you call it? An experiment?
It was a project. It was a midlife crisis, and it was a reality show that nobody asked me to do, really. But it was part fiction, because the first part of the book is, I imagined two novellas of what the very best that could happen and the very worst, which was very much like writing characters in my movies that were extreme in both ways. But I had to write them before I actually did it. I could have never written that part once I had done the trip, which actually took 9 days and 21 rides. So I think it was something. I always liked to hitchhike when I was young. I did hitchhike a little in Provincetown before I did this to go to a beach I liked. And I believe hitchhiking, I want to bring it back. I think that it's an adventure that everybody can have, and I'm for it. I've always been a hitchhiker.
You wrote those novellas in part because you didn't want to find yourself in like a John Steinbeck Travels with Charlie.
Well, if you read the book, that was, you know, not true. It came out the
right
time to the thing this year where he made that up. Half the time he was not, didn't talk to those people, stayed in fancy hotels. It was, and it's still in print and won prizes, and it's fake.
And it's so disappointing to learn that, isn't it?
Well, to me it wasn't, because it came in perfect for my introduction to the book when I was going to do it for real. You know what I mean? Because I purposely did not read that book, but now I didn't have to, because he made it up. So maybe it gave me the point of making it up and then doing it for real. You could never make up what really happened. Because it wasn't as extreme, but the people were very good. And people say, were you scared? You know, I'm scared of staying home and never being new and never thinking of new things and never having new experiences. I'm not scared of going out in the world and meeting new people.
So you imagine best things that could happen and the worst things that could happen. Which did you prefer writing? Were they equally demanding?
Well, it was fun to think up the worst, although my assistant, who is more conservative than I, said I couldn't tell the difference between the best and the worst, which I could. You know, I mean, I have sex in a demolition derby. A lot of things happen that are kind of exciting and crazy that maybe other people wouldn't want to happen. But thinking up the worst that could happen to you when you're poisoned by somebody and have diarrhea and they won't let you out, that is the worst thing that could happen when you're hitchhiking. You don't get to say, hey, can you pull over to pee? You know, if you have a problem with that, you really aren't in control anymore. You forget that. So that was the first thing I was paranoid about hitchhiking is, oh, my God, the human body. How do you deal with that? And so it took a little getting used to. You don't eat a lot when you're hitchhiking. Mm. It's not a good idea.
And then there is the question of, like, what if someone's a terrible driver?
I know, but they weren't. And, you know, and I'm a backseat driver, too. That was one of my main worries. And in the worst part, I had that a lot, the imagined worst part. In real life, maybe I was less critical. I was so happy to get in any car that I didn't care how they drove. Because sometimes you'd wait for, like, 10 hours and you'd think, oh, this is going to take 30 years for me to get here. So I was maybe less critical of people's driving, but I don't remember anybody driving scarily at all.
There's so many sweet stories in the actual, when you get to what really happened, that section of the book, including people who had no idea who you were and might seem to have been inclined to judge you or somehow think that they didn't want to hang around with you, but they were very kind.
They were very kind, and poor people pulled over to give me money a lot, thinking I was a homeless man, which was very, very touching. It shocked me the first time when this farmer, when he pulled over, pulled out his wallet and tried to give me a $10 or $20 bill. I was like amazed by that. And so, people were good. It was a very optimistic trip, I think. I mean, there were parts that were terrifying just because of how long you had to wait and that kind of standing there in the pouring rain for 2 days. But the people themselves, there wasn't a bad person that I couldn't wait to get out of the car with. They were all kind of great, and I'm still friends with some of them.
So you're like a really young 68, and at the time that you did this, you were 66. But do you think there's something about the vulnerability of advancing age that caused people to pull over, whereas when you were like 38, they wouldn't have?
Well, I make a joke. When you're young, you have an erection hitchhiking. And when you're married, you have a Viagra. So, yeah, I didn't get hit on a lot. And when you're 16 and 18, you get hit on one out of two rides, I promise you, no matter what your sexuality is. But sex is a part of hitchhiking. It is a joke about hitchhiking. The fear is part of hitchhiking, like a killer is going to pick you up or you're a killer, or sex is always. It's thought of no matter what. It's the first thing you think when you get in the car. Where are we here, you know? And that's part of the fun of hitchhiking. It's like a blind date.
And you have to make conversation right away.
Well, it's your job as a hitchhiker to talk. And nobody picks up a hitchhiker because they don't want to talk. But you let them pick the subject. I didn't want to talk about myself. I had to sometimes. And I did because the longer you talk, the longer you stay in the car. It's like phone sex. But at the same time...
So you're like Scheherazade, basically. You just keep telling stories and they'll take you another 10 miles.
Well, no, not with everybody. I didn't. A lot of the people, I got them to tell me their stories, which were much more interesting than me.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Martin on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Martin.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Hey, John.
Hi.
I was wondering, from the early days as a director, producer, until your current state as one of the statesmen, so to speak.
As a filth elder, unemployed director, yeah.
How were you, viewed when you came up and dealt with? Did you feel any... I don't know if the word is discrimination or did they just off-put their...
What, in the beginning?
I just wondered.
Well, in the beginning we got reviews that said, like a septic tank explosion, it must be seen to be believed. So I took that as a compliment. I think we were always received in the right way. I think I always had an audience right from the beginning, even though we didn't get good reviews or anything. We had a punk rock audience in the hippie years when there was no such thing as punk or a word or anything. My original audience to those movies wasn't all gay. It was bikers. It was people that didn't fit in their own minorities. And they hung around together and they saw the humor in this. So they wanted to be surprised. They were in on it with me. They always felt on my side when they saw those movies. So did I feel discriminated against? I didn't, really.
Are you surprised that it's been challenging to get your kids' movie made?
No, because my last movie didn't make money. And that's all it is. Hollywood. It's always been that. If A Dirty Shame had been a giant hit, I would have gotten the money in a minute. The business changed very much. The independent film world, now it's television. I mean, really, television is better than independent film these days. So I think the business has changed very much. But I've always had a way to tell stories. So, I write books. I do these shows all the time. So it would be very traumatic for me if I had only had a movie career. But all the careers I have are equally as important to me. The only way you can insult me is to say, do you have a hobby?
We have an email.
Then I go into a tirade against you.
We have an email here from Steve who wants to know, what is your greatest fear?
My greatest fear? I guess ill health. I'm 68. I know other people my age that for no apparent reason drop dead of a heart attack or something. So my mom died recently. She had a great life. She was 90-some years old. But I saw that last year where you really don't have a choice of anything. And you are completely out of control of what can happen to you. And that is, that's scary, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I fear that.
What's your favorite room in your house?
My favorite room in my house? Well, I guess my bedroom, because that's where I relax and that's where I read. But my office, I jump out of bed to go in every morning. I have two of them, one where I think up weird and the afternoon where I sell it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go to Rick in Plano. Hi, Rick.
Chris, I'd like to commend your guest on the compilation of Christmas music he put together in an album a couple years ago. That was a great collection.
I had a good time with that album. I have another one called A Date with John Waters. Did you ever hear that one?
No.
That's all love music. Thank you. I had a good time with that Christmas album. I had fun doing that.
Did you appear in the movie Breaker Morant?
No, that's John Waters, the Australian actor. And then there's the other John Waters, the one in Ireland that causes all the trouble, saying that people don't have depression, says anti-gay things, and was married to Sinead O'Connor. So there's three John Waters, and the Google alerts, we get all three.
Do you ever, are you always positive which one is which when something comes up, do you think?
Yeah, except once one of the John Waters was cast in the Addams Family, and people thought it was me, and I get that. I get that. I could be in the Addams Family. If I could sing, I probably would have been in it.
So do you think the warnings about the dangers of hitchhiking are overblown? Because I grew up in the 70s, and there were, you know, TV commercials about how deadly it was to hitchhike.
You know, it's as soon as I say that that isn't true, then somebody will buy the book and gets killed, and I'll get blamed. Of course, it's dangerous, but driving in a car is more dangerous to me. I'm amazed that every day you aren't in a car accident. Think how fast people are going, how stupid people some people are, and what bad drivers most people. And you're going 80 miles an hour, an inch away from somebody. It's dangerous, I guess. Although, even Mary Vivian Pierce, who was in my early movies in the 70s, she hitchhiked alone from New Orleans to my house in San Francisco, looking like Jean Harlow, which she looked like every day there, in heels and everything, and had no trouble. But yet, I have a male friend that was raped hitchhiking by a truck driver. So, yeah, it can happen. It definitely can happen. I don't know, though. I believe in the goodness of people. I mean, you can walk out of your house today and someone can run you down in the car. Anything can happen. So I don't know. To me, you take chances in life.
Have you always believed in the goodness of people in the same way that you believe in it now, if the question makes sense to you?
I think I'm not religious. I don't believe in any God I've heard of, but I do believe in that. And I think that is spiritual in a way, that I think you're born with damaged genes, you can, but something happens to you. Something happens. So, I am a basic believer in that most people, there are a few that they're wired wrong. That you're never going to be able to straighten them out. But that is a tiny percent. I think most people, if you are afraid of ever meeting one of them, then you'll never meet all the good people that are out there that are pretty great and take chances.
Are there any other filmmakers out there whose movies you never want to miss?
Oh, plenty of them. Ulrich Seidel, Todd Solondz, Francois Ozon, Pedro Almodovar, Bruno Dumont. I can list lots of them. They usually make depressing French movies.
The new book by writer, director, and performer John Waters is called Carsick. John Waters hitchhikes across America. He's scheduled to be in town on May 29th at the Kessler Theater for a live show called This Filthy World. John, it's been quite a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to coming to Dallas. I haven't been there for a while, so I'm looking forward to it.
It's changed a lot.
It's my first book signing, so that'll be fun.
Number one book signing. Thank you so much.
All right.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.